Today, I'm looking at the seventh verse of these eight verses. So I'll start by reading it. So I'll just say that my head is still very congested and I'm not sure, I can't really hear myself. So if I'm a bit low, can you just indicate? And if I'm shouting at you, can you kind of let me know that as well? So I'm really, it's like I'm talking in a swimming pool. So. In brief, directly or indirectly, may I give help and joy to my mothers, and may I take all their harm and pain secretly upon myself. So I'm going to read a couple of other translations of the same verse. In brief, may I offer benefit and joy to all my mothers, both directly and indirectly. May I quietly take upon myself all hurts and pains of my mothers. And the other one, in short, may I offer both directly and indirectly all joy and benefit to all beings, my mothers, and may I secretly take on all of their hurt and suffering. So I quite like the translations that say, the one that says, all beings, my mothers. I think it makes more clear what the idea of my mothers is about, really. So I'm sure we're all aware of the fact that, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, there is this view that all beings through the endless rounds of existence, the endless rounds of arising and passing, all beings have at some point been my mother. That's an idea that I think some of us maybe find a bit difficult to relate to. But what it's saying, basically, I think, is all beings are interconnected. That through the endless arising and passing of phenomena, all beings are inextricably linked to all other beings. So may I offer both directly and indirectly. I also quite like all joy and benefit. That's quite nice. I like the idea of offering joy and benefit, as well as help and joy. Quite like benefit rather than help. That, you know, may every action that I partake in be of benefit. There's the line in the Bodhicharya Avatara, which says something like, may all my encounters with beings be of benefit to those beings. May it give meaning to their life. Which I think is really rather lovely. And also, I feel so many of our interactions can be so meaningless. That to have a sense of purpose, that may all my interactions give benefit, give joy, give meaning, is a very purposeful vow, as it were. So as we heard from Dhammarati, this verse is directly referring to the practice of Tonglen. It's referring to give and take. So the give and take is the Tonglen practice. It's also seen sometimes as equalizing self and other. That's another term we sometimes hear. Exchanging ourself, exchanging self and other. And again, there's that wonderful bit in the Bodhicharya Avatara, in the meditation verses, where there's a whole meditation of exchanging self and other. And it's quite an interesting exercise to do. So I remember Dhammadina and I leading a study retreat on the Bodhicharya Avatara many years ago. And we did this as a practice. So if I remember, it's thinking of somebody who you consider superior to yourself and then imagining yourself seen from their point of view. And then you do it with somebody who you might consider inferior. And then the interesting one was doing it with somebody you feel is the same. And that in a way, all of those things are just comparison and they're just continuing the sense of separate self and other. But it was quite interesting when we talked afterwards how some people found it very easy to think of people they might consider inferior, but they couldn't really think of many people that they considered superior. And other people found it very easy to consider people who they considered superior and not really consider inferior. But exploring that and coming to realise it doesn't really make any difference. It's still comparison, wherever you locate yourself. You're still locating yourself in some way that's... Your location is still the self. Your point of reference is still the sense of self. Whether you've located that self as superior, inferior, or the same. So part of the Tonglen practice and part of this verse is to equalise, not in the sense of being the same as, but in the sense of breaking through that sense of separation. So we do tend to have that point of view of self as the reference point. And I think there's no shame or blame attached to that. As other people have said, it's using that term, it's hardwired. We're kind of set up to see the world like that. And we're encouraged to see it like that in so many ways. So we tend to relate to the self as important. And therefore we are either attached to, hostile to, or indifferent to whatever's around us. If we have a strong sense of self, then anything else will be something, anybody else or anything else that we relate to as outside that sense of self will either strengthen the self, the sense of identity, in which case we want more of it, which is the poison of greed. This is all very basic, but a friend of mine once said, never overlook the obvious. So I'm never overlooking the obvious. If we perceive what's around us as hostile, then the poison of hatred kicks in as we try to push away and defend and protect the self. If it poses neither threat nor pleasure, we're pretty indifferent. There's a saying in Spanish which I came across when I was first living in Spain, teaching the Metta Bhavana, which is for the third stage, the neutral stage. It was, someone passes through your life making no noise, which I really liked as a phrase. No noise. They don't make any noise. They leave no traces. So we're indifferent to them. But of course, this verse is saying we cannot be indifferent to any being, that all beings are interrelated. If it helps, we can think all beings have been my mother, are my mother, or perhaps I am their mother. Although in my own case, I'm not sure that would be helpful. I don't think I've got much maternal. But, you know, whatever helps is to feel connected. So we can either cling to or push away. But really what we're realising, or we need to come to realise, not just intellectually but very deeply, is that it is an illusion anyway. That sense of self is an illusion. It needs neither protected nor reinforced. And that's not only on the individual scale. It's not only that I need to learn not to shore up the I, or to push away what's hostile to the I, but it also happens on a group level. And a writer called David Loy, who I enjoy his particular way of writing, talks about the we-go as well as the ego, if that makes sense to those that aren't English speakers. You know, we say I, and then we say we when we mean the collective. So he talks about having a we-go as well as an ego. So we have a sense of our group identity as much as our individual identity. And that group identity can become threatened, or that group identity can become strengthened by the groups that we're in or around. And thinking about that, and thinking about the group, say the nation state, and how that need to defend can actually end up with preemptive action to stop what might be hostile. We're not so different on an individual level. Sometimes preemptive action. You know, we have a story about what might be hostile. And before it gets me, I'll get it. So we can also look at that as a tendency or a pattern, kind of preemptive ego action. So Tonglen is working strongly against that tendency of holding the ego separate and pushing away what's hostile. So rather than taking in what will make me feel more strong and better, what we're actually taking in is the suffering of the world. And what we're giving out, rather than an action outwards that pushes away, it's an action outward that connects. So the whole thing is about connecting. It's about bringing in the suffering and pushing out metta. So we have compassion coming in with the in-breath and metta going out with the out-breath. So it's quite an interesting turnaround of almost a natural desire to take in and push out. But rather than taking in towards the ego and pushing out away from the ego, we've completely flipped and we're taking in the suffering of the others and pushing, not pushing out, but sending out waves of metta. So there's a suggestion through many of these verses about taking harm unto oneself. And of course, this is not self-harm or self-hatred. And I think that's been covered in some of the other verses. It's a concern for the well-being of others. And it might be that sometimes that concern will make us go beyond ourselves. So it might be that there is a little bit of a sense of discomfort or hardship that comes into this practice. Perhaps we're willing to take on something that we wouldn't normally or naturally feel comfortable doing. And that can be a practice in itself to think, am I willing to just go a little bit beyond my, what we call our comfort zone? And people have different senses of what that might mean. When our ordination retreats for women are held in Acashavana in Spain. And some people absolutely love that place. And as soon as they get there, they expand into the landscape. I hate it. Well, I don't hate it. I love it, but I'm so outside my comfort zone in that place. And I've been, except for this year, I've been once or twice every year for 10 years. And I do actually see it as a practice. And I don't mean in a kind of, oh, poor me, I go outside my comfort zone. It's a joyful practice because the reason I'm there is to welcome women into our order. So I'm very happy to do it. But if I was left to my own devices, I'd never go there. Frankly, if I was left to my own devices, I'd never live at Adistana. Not because of Adistana, which I love, but that part of England is not somewhere that I would have ever imagined myself living in. So sometimes in our life, in our practice, we do joyfully what is the right thing or the next thing or the best thing to do. And sometimes that will take us outside our comfort zone. In one of the groups I was in about support for pioneers in new places, some of us talked about the benefits of moving outside our linguistic comfort zone, for example. And when I first went to live in Spain, I realised how much refuge I took in my ability to converse, that my ability to make connection through speech was quite primary. And for a while, I couldn't do it. You know, my Spanish was very basic. And I found it very disconcerting. But I found it so valuable. And I think I learned things about myself I would never have learned if I'd stayed in the London Buddhist Centre, which was definitely a place I knew and where I could communicate very easily. So sometimes our concern for well-being will push us beyond our own limits. And the motivation for that is to achieve supreme happiness for self and other. So it's not that we just want to do it for other, but that in the doing of that, the breaking through of something also gives liberation and joy. And we've heard about that in other verses. So all of these verses are pushing towards the desire to redress the natural bias towards self. And if this is about bodhicitta, it's about the relative bodhicitta, this particular verse, because it's still framed in terms of self and other. It still talks in terms of the need to break through this self and other separation. And it still talks in terms of favouring the other over the self as a way to redress that balance. Tomorrow's verse looks at absolute bodhicitta. And in the same way as the Eightfold Path ends with wisdom, but then through that wisdom the entire path becomes a different path, I think as we understand the absolute bodhicitta, all of these eight verses take on a different meaning. So I look forward to hearing about that tomorrow. But we're still in the realm of needing to work with our mental states, and that's also the practice and the practical part of these verses. So I was reminded when thinking about this of the Dhammapada, of the verses which say, "He abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, he robbed me." In those who harbour such thoughts, hatred is not appeased. He abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who do not harbour such thoughts, hatred is appeased. Hatred never ceases through hatred in this world. Through love alone does it cease. This is an eternal law. So the bodhicitta practice is working on that truth. It's working on the need to change from a defended posture to an open and connected posture. And we also have our mind precepts. The mind precepts are just working very directly on those three poisons of greed, hatred and delusion. And they're not just individual poisons, but they're poisons that are alive in the world. They're poisons that stalk the world, as it were. And in the same way that the ego can be seen collectively, then the effect of those poisons can also be seen collectively and even institutionally. There are institutions which support greed. There are institutions that support hatred. And there are institutions that maintain delusion. And there's no need to go into that at this minute. I'm sure everybody's aware and, you know, works with that. But it does strike me that our mind precepts are so potent and so powerful a way of working against not only the illusion of self, but actually working against the whole sense of samsara. And we know that samsara is endless. We know that samsara, we will not defeat samsara in a single bodhicitta practice. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do the practice or that we shouldn't have that orientation of really believing that our practice of the precepts, our practice of bodhicitta will have an effect in the world. We know that those poisons are the cause of suffering in the world. And in the bodhicitta practice that we do within the order, it's a beautiful practice. I was very sorry I wasn't well enough to come when we did it collectively yesterday. But it's such a beautiful practice. And to begin by just reflecting, all beings like myself seek happiness and its causes. All beings like myself wish to avoid suffering. All beings like myself create conditions for present and future suffering. What a pity. I just love that. What a pity. And it's not a pity in a kind of, oh, poor me, poor you, poor them. It's such a pity that that is how we live. That we constantly create and recreate the conditions for self and other suffering. But we have ways to work against that. And it's one of the reasons why, for me, the Dhamma is the solution to the world's ills, as it were, and not any other solution. Which is not to say that other solutions are unnecessary. Sometimes they're necessary. But a dharmic basis for a response to the suffering of the world is so crucial. And this practice also is an insight into non-duality. It's all beings like myself. I'm not separate from that. I too am the cause of suffering for myself and others. I have been in the past, and I probably will be in the future. What a pity. And what this says to me so strongly, this practice, and why I find it such a potent practice, is that it works against polarisation. And I've come to feel that polarisation is the world's greatest ill. Not only out there in the world, but also within our own world of Tri Ratna, within our own bubble that we live in. I've been very pained at times to just observe the polarisation that can build up over certain issues or certain things. And for me, 2017 wasn't a greatly easy year for many of us. For me, partly what I found painful was the response of some order members to other order members. Something about the way we would speak to each other sometimes, the kind of discourses that would become a bit common. And I think there was a bit of a peak, and it changed and it moved on a bit. But it seemed to me that it's the last thing that we need is polarisation within our own community. The world's on fire. And if we're so busy arguing about whose bucket of water is the best bucket of water, how will we ever put the flames out? You know, how do we ever work against that? And I think it's so important we don't allow the polarisations that are happening in the world, whether they're political polarisations or ideological polarisations, that we don't allow them to taint, to poison our response to the world's problems. How do we fight the demons of the world without demonising, if that makes sense? You know, how do we stay connected without polarising? So today's theme that will be picked up later on today is about how do we open the doors of our centres to all beings, and not just to the beings that are like us in some way. How do we actually create conditions where we're a community that's welcoming to all beings, regardless of race, gender, caste, outlook on life, political outlook on life, conditioning. You know, how do we make ourselves a welcoming community? So I'm quite struck that this verse says secretly or quietly. And the first time I read this, this word really jumped out at me, and I thought, what does this mean exactly? I thought, well, what would the opposite of quietly be? And I thought, stridently, if that's the word. So for non-English speakers, I think that would mean shout about it loudly, kind of make a big thing about it. And I think that sometimes some of our order and our community's concern about when we talk in terms of working with the world's problems, that there's a fear that we'll do that in such a way that we've lost, or we might lose our dharmic perspective, and that we might come at it from an ideological or a political viewpoint. And I think it's important we go below them and just come back to dukkha and just come back to conditioning. And some conditionings make life more difficult than others. And come back to ways of working with those conditionings and finding what our own conditioning really is and where it makes us defensive, where it makes us welcoming. So coming back to the bodhicitta practice, it's not just a practice in meditation, but I think it's a practice, a live practice to take on as a collective, as a community, that we really try to work with a dharmic response to the world's issues and the world's problems. The bodhisattva ideal is at the very heart of our order and our movement. It's there in our ordination vows. Everybody in this room has accepted our ordination for the benefit of all beings. It's quite explicit. That's what our order is all about. Bhante set up our order and as part of his own bodhisattva practice. He's made that quite explicit. Some of you were there, a couple of you were there in the talk I gave on the order retreat at Bodh Gaya, just before the convention. And I talked about having given a talk in America where Bhante was present. He'd chaired these talks. And in it I said, I got a bit carried away and I was saying, our order is the expression of Bhante's bodhisattva ordination, and that he'd studied the bodhisattva precepts with Dardo Rinpoche. And one of those is the gathering of community. And I suddenly remembered that Bhante was sitting there and I kind of looked over. And fortunately, he was nodding. So I took that as an agreement that, in fact, we were definitely formed out of Bhante's bodhisattva precepts. So our very order is here as a bodhicitta practice. We are here to respond to the cries of the world. And we do that, first of all, by working on our own sense of self, and by working on our collective sense of support and help. So I'm going to finish by reading something from Bhante, which I love very much, and I know it's very popular reading. And it's when he talks about why he's a Buddhist. And I think it's very relevant for what we're going to explore this afternoon. I believe that humanity is basically one. I believe it is possible for any human being to communicate with any other human being, to feel for any other human being, to be friends with any other human being. This is what I truly and deeply believe. It is part of my own life, part of me. I cannot live without this belief, and I would rather die than give it up. So there's more to the quote, but that's the bit that I just find it so deeply moving. And I really want us to be a community that can communicate with all beings and can open our doors to all beings on the basis of the Dharma. And as a practice for me, I want to know what polarizes me with other beings, and I want to make that conscious and shift it. So maybe in our groups, this morning in the home groups, we could explore, are there areas where our own conditioning, maybe inadvertently and unwillingly, creates polarisation? And do we have practices to work against that? Thank you.